Welcome to B2B, the Business Club podcast. Our guest today needs no introduction formally, but we'll give you one anyway. Professor Carl Chin, MBE. Can we call you Carl?
Yeah, of course you can call me Carl. That's who I am, isn't it? I'm one of you, lads, you know.
Birmingham.
I mean, metaphorically speaking.
Yeah, that's it.
How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. Yeah, very good, thanks, and thank you for inviting me today.
No problem. Thank you for coming down as a famous Villa fan. It must be no small thing to be sitting in St Andrews.
Listen, you promised me you would not mention this. How could I ever face up to going to the Aston Social, the Aston Tavern again, when you grasped me up?
The backdrop gives it away.
Well, this is business, isn't it? So it's,
yeah.
We just wanted to kind of have a chat with you, talk about the business that you're in, that you've been involved with, and a little bit about your life, really.
Yeah, no problem.
So if we could start with a brief introduction to yourself.
Yeah, so I'm a social historian. I was a bookmaker for many years. My dad and my granddad were illegal bookmakers until cash betting away from the racecourse was legalised in 61. Dad was Sparkbrook, Ladypool Road area. Granddad was Sparkbrook, Ladypool Road area. My great-grandparents were Sparkbrook, Ladypool Road area. And although I grew up better off because I was the son of a bookie, we grew up in what we used to call Springfield, which was the borders of Moseley, Hall Green and Spark Hill. Although I grew up better off, Dad and Mum were very proud to be Backstreet Kids. So while the old man was Sparkbrook, Mum was from Aston. And that's why I'm a Villa fan, because I had no choice. Mum was Villa mad. And
you're born into it, yeah?
Born into it. Yep. You're born into it. And Dad's side with Villa, funny enough, from Sparkbrook. Half the family were Blues and half were Villa. But Mum and Dad were very proud Backstreet Brummies. And although, as I said, I grew up better off, I grew up with a very strong sense of pride in the Backstreet values of my mum and dad, my grandparents, my great aunts and uncles. Very strong connections with all of them. I worked on the Ladypool Road from when I was 13 in the betting shops. I have had a gun at my head twice, armed robberies, had an attack with a machete one day in the office. Knife another time. So
curry every lunch. Well,
it didn't start. The curry houses didn't really start the Balti Belt to 79, 80, 81. And so yeah, I did have Baltis. I had a Balti in Adils, which was one of the first ones. Mm-hmm. Al Faisal's, and then there was Imran's and Salim's, very close to our betting shop. But I grew up very much better off in a monetary sense, but culturally very working class. Mom and Dad's values were imbued in them from their upbringing. Dad was very proud to come out to Stuckley Street, just off the Label Road. Mom was very proud to come out to Whitehouse Street, Aston. And I'll give an example of that. When our mom was dying, and she lived with us for 5 years after the old man died, she was chronically ill. And my wife, Kay, was just a wonderful carer. And towards the end, I said to our mom, when you go, what do you want? And I'm talking now in the old Brummy speech. I went, take me up. I said, what do you mean? I know where I meant. I said, take me back home. I want to get back to Aston. And when my mum died, I took her back to Aston. And we took her down Whitehouse Street. I don't know if you know Whitehouse Street. It's off the Aston Road North.
Vaguely, yeah.
Just before the old, before Aston Cross.
Yeah.
And there's a pub on the corner called the Albion. It's now Christopher's Lounge.
Yeah.
I pop in there for a drink after the match, because I'm sitting with me people, the ones that have gone before. And as we went down Whitehouse Street, where the entry would have been to the yard of back-to-backs where our mum and Nan had lived, there was nothing there now, but mum's cousin stood and a school pal stood, because that's what the street would have done, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
and I took her to Aston Parish Church. And when we left Aston Parish Church, as soon as we hit the whole pub, the funeral director got out and walked her down Whitton Lane. And I took her then to Perry Bar and back to Villa Park for the wake. Because...
How long ago was it?
That was... our mum's been gone 11 years this year. 11 years this year. But as always with me. Our mum and our nan. Oh, mad football fans. My nan, 4 foot 11 and a half. Fighting Aston. First sight I ever saw was our nan at the old end. an away fan. We were standing in them days in the late, mid to late 60s, we still stood with each other.
Yeah.
And an away fan nicked our kids, Villa out and our nan turned around. Can I swear? I turned around, and what our nan had, she had a finger, the index finger on her right hand was missing, it was cut off in a power press accident. But she had, when they cut it off, she had a bigger knuckle. And when her hit ya, she didn't slap, punch. And we used to call it a nanny punch. Well, it did half hurt. And her turn round, it was, well, obviously you look big to me, I was only 9 or 10. And her turn round, what are you, bastard? And she hit him with a right hander. And he was so shocked that by then men were coming round and got rid of him. So I was the first one of the family to go past 15 at school. I was the first one to take O levels. I was the first one to get to a grammar school. I knew how lucky I was. So my whole life, my whole purpose has been to pay back, not only to my mum and dad and my grandparents, but to all those working class people who never had a choice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the first one in centuries that had a choice. Well, I owe a debt to those that came before.
Does that play a part then in what you do now? It's always mindful of it.
It's with me all the time. Even when we was in the bookmaking, I love the bookmaking because I was talking to, I loved talking to, people had come in, and in the morning it was older people that would come in, and they knew my great-grandparents. And, you know, it was the same when I went out with my auntie Win and our nan to say Pai Pais, the Forget-Me-Nots Club, or to the Aston Social, or to King Stanley X Servicemen's, where different great-uncles. And they'd be talking to me about my great-grandparents.
Yeah.
So I was fortunate looking back in that I have a bond with both the south side of Birmingham and the north side of Birmingham. There's not many Brummies have got that. Because we tend to be very insular, don't we? You know, if you're from the southeast side, you stick to the southeast. Or if you're southwest or north, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I feel I was fortunate in that. It gave me an understanding of both sides. And I was very lucky to have not grown up in poverty, to have grown up well off, to have had those opportunities, but to still have had those cultural values of working class people instilled in me.
Mm-hmm. I find that that's instilled in quite a lot of people who have grown up in Birmingham, really. It's working class, and we've got those morals and those...
Yeah.
Those intrinsic kind of values of family and hard work and stuff like that. I feel like, especially our generation and generations above.
Why are you looking at me when you said generations above?
You're
that's the second knock he's had at me now,
to the head. I'd walk out. Oh,
do you find though with what you do now, particularly that Blues and Villa doesn't really matter because you're not as much as an avid Villa you are. You're not. It's not. I don't feel like Blues are on you.
I would definitely say. I'd defy anybody to say I've ever insulted the Blues publicly. Even when I'm down the match and they start singing songs, there's certain verses I won't sing. You know what I mean? I won't sing them because I'm in the public eye and Birmingham City Football Club carries the name of Assiton. Yeah. I don't like the nastiness that's come into a lot of the rivalry, but I think the one I get very often is by Blues fans. They come up to you, love what you do, Carl, but... And I know what the one's going to be. You're a Villa so-and-so.
Yeah.
And they go, how come you're from South Birmingham? And then I have to tell them the whole story of the family, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so I was going to touch on that because during my research for you, I touched upon the fact that you are a direct ancestor of one of the Peaky Blinders.
Descendant, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So... Notoriously Birmingham City?
No. And you see, what we have to look at now, it's become quite dangerous, a rivalry that's growing up around the Peaky Blinders were Blues fans. The real Peaky Blinders were not around. Let's deconstruct all of this. This is not football I'm talking about now.
Yeah.
This is fact. There were no Peaky Blinders in the 1920s. The series has been brilliant. It's brought a lot of attention to Birmingham, but it's drama. It's based on one gang in Small Heath in the 1920s. There was no Peaky Blinder gang. There were numerous Peaky Blinder gangs, not in the 1920s, in the late 19th century, and they weren't in one area. Now, actually, this is Bawdsley, if we start nitpicking. Now, the districts overlap, of course they do. But the main gangs were in the 1890s and the turn of the 20th century. So the idea that these men were interested in football is wrong. And we shouldn't really be... I understand the connection because of Stephen Knight and he's a Birmingham City fan and, you know, bringing the name of Small Heath in. I understand all that. But I think we've also got to be a bit careful, because I talked to a lot of Villa fans who were really antagonistic to the portrayal of one side.
Blues being...
Blues weaponise it, you know, like Blues fans weaponise it somewhat.
So I think we have to be careful. And that's all I'm saying is I'm not knocking him, but I think we have to look at the reality. Who and where were the real gangs? There was just down the road here. In Bawdsley and Derry Ten, there were numerous gangs. The worst gangs were the Bar Street Gang from Great Bar Street, Milk Street Gang, Park Street Gang, which we'd now see would be Derry Ten to Digbeth. Across the way, the Barford Street Gang in Highgate, the Highgate Street Gang, the Sparkbrook Street Gang, which my great-great-uncle was a leader of, John Derry. His younger brother was my great-grandfather, who was a real Peaky Blinder. A violent, vile, wife-abusing thug, petty thief, a criminal. There was then the Charles Henry Street Gang. There was the Whitehouse Street Gang, my mum's street from Aston, one of the worst gangs. There was the Ten Arches Gang, which was a neutral stroke Aston gang. Do you know, as you go along the Lichfield Road and you come to the bridge across Aston Station?
Yeah.
Right? Just to the right there by the canal, there's Ten Arches. So you're right by a main thoroughfare, but it's isolated. There were gangs in Gloucester Green. There were gangs in Ladywood, the Summerhill Gang. In Hockley, the Camden Street Gang. So the idea that there was one gang that supported one particular team, they didn't support football teams.
Did they used to use that just as a vehicle?
No, they didn't even bother with the football. You know, so the idea, these were violent thugs. Now, within those gangs, there were young men, a bit like the hooligans of the 70s and 80s, who were in it for the fighting, and then got married, and the wives dragged them away. But others remained involved. And most of these that were involved were hardened criminals as well as violent men. So let's look at my great-grandfather. 5'4¼". Petty thief, my great-granduncle, Bill, on my dad's side. That's my dad's mum's side. The Derricks, the Peaky Blinders.
Yeah.
My dad's paternal side, my great-uncle, Bill Chin, saw him steal a cider making from outside a shop, a butcher's shop on the Ladycourt Road. Is that a big crime? Now, it's a big crime to the shop owner, but it's petty theft. It got done for attacking the police. Peaky Blinders hated the police. On one occasion, he had a fight with the man, picked up a shovel, that never worked, so he picked up a meat cleaver. He cleaved the man's head. He got 3 years. He could get 5 years for uttering false coins. But the worst thing he used to do, he used to come home regularly mucky drunk. And old people from our dad's street told me this in the 80s when I interviewed them. And then I found court records. He threatened to kill her, he beat her up, my great-grandmother. These are not men to be admired.
So is this a frustration of yours, kind of the glamorisation of... And again, it's kind of people, isn't it, finding the difficult balance between drama and reality, where they'll glorify something, they'll take that in there, right, this is us. Yeah, but without knowing the actual details, people are based on not nice people.
Again, I've got to put around this that what Stephen Knight has done is tremendous. But where I sometimes have had, well, not sometimes, where I've had a problem is when people associated with, whether it be the BBC or other, with the series, are saying it's based on a real gang. It's not. The term Peaky Blinders was a pre-First World War term. Basically, it was a generic term for the hooligans of Birmingham. There wasn't just one gang, there were numerous gangs. So we have to make sure that whilst we understand that there's a drama and we appreciate the drama and it's got a compelling soundtrack, charismatic performances, wonderful storyline, it's not real.
Yeah.
And gangsters are not men to be admired. They are not mafia-style dons that respect women, are kind to children, and that look after the elderly. No, they don't. They abuse their own. And the Peaky Blinders not only battled each other and baited the police, they bullied the poor amongst whom they lived. So we have to get the reality out there. Because there's
not as romantic.
It's not romantic, man. And I understand why it's not as good a story, but that's the reality.
Of course. It's like the actors, isn't it? It's like the actors in the soap supply villains and then get stick in the street from people when they're going shopping and they've got to explain, look, I'm a character. Yeah.
So I think it's really important that we get that perspective on the reality correct, and that we recognise that drama is drama. It's not historical reality. And unfortunately for a lot of people, it has become the historical reality.
Yeah. It's a little bit like The Cry as well, though, when they made the film when it's Handsome. Who was it that played
Kemp's brothers? One time, didn't they?
Tom Hardy, wasn't it? Yeah, the Kemp's were the original, weren't they? And then Tom Hardy
played. And it's this idea that, you know, the East End was safe when the Crays were around, but it was if they liked you.
Yeah.
But if they didn't like her, it wasn't safe.
She was the hat.
You know what I mean? Or whoever. Mm-hmm. So,
how accurate was it, the stories of them coming to Birmingham and being told to leave Birmingham?
Well, I can only tell you what I was told by the late Gordon Futrell. And there's loads of stories about them coming to Birmingham and massive fights with hundreds involved. Listen, back in the 70s, when we used to go away as football fans, you'd be a big load of you coming off the football special. And if the art men at the front ran, you ran. Yeah. You know, basically, the fighting was between a few people.
Yeah.
And it was the same back then. Can you imagine hundreds fighting in Birmingham City Centre with the Crays? The Crays had a small mob, a nasty mob, vile, horrible mob. What happened was, according to Gordon Futrell, who I interviewed, he says one night him and his brothers were at the club, the Cedar Club, owned by Eddie Futrell, and these Londoners came in and says, Reggie and Ronnie have sent us, we want to have it. And they, typical brothers, went, Reggie and Ronnie, you. And it kicked off. But there was four or five of them and four or five of the Futrells. And they won, the Futrells won.
Yeah.
I put them in a taxi to get back home to the station. So that was what I was told. There are all these stories of big battles at the Stonehouse pub.
Yeah,
which you heard.
That's the story.
You know, there's no evidence of any of that.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it would be, but I'm not stupid. I only write about gangsters and be dead for 100 years. So don't expect me to delve into that one deeply.
So when did you actually take the jump to getting into academia and academic learning? Because you work at, you at the university now?
No, they got rid of me. I was made unexpected redundant 11 years ago for my unique and pioneering role as community historian.
Oh, okay.
And then I was disillusioned, so I left my teaching post, I think, 6 years ago.
Okay.
7 years ago, I've just had enough. Mm. Because I feel that too many red brick universities are infused with an elitist attitude, and that people from our backgrounds, you do hit a glass ceiling and you have to keep on justifying yourself. I faced a lot of prejudice in my time, not necessarily at the university, but throughout my public career over my background and particularly over my accent. And I can't tell you how often that happened, particularly at the BBC, where I was called in by managers to say that I had complaints about the way I spoke. This is local radio.
Yeah.
And I was called in three occasions.
Literally every DJ on WM at the time.
Yeah.
Kind of brought me out.
Not that worries me, you see. I was probably the first one that had such a broad accent and also used dialect words. And I was called in on one occasion because they said, look, he's exaggerated his accent. And I said to the manager, I said, you know, when you're talking to somebody from your own background, you wouldn't know this because he's middle class.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you do talk broader, don't we?
Yeah,
and because I was the first one that spoke so broadly, when you're talking on and recording, it sounds broader again. It's magnified, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I had people writing in saying I was making money from the accent. I'd have made a lot more money if I just spoke RP. A lot more money. On one occasion, I was pulled in because I'd used the term wench. Now, I would only use the term wench to an older Brummy woman or my daughters who use the term or other young women that understand it.
Yeah.
Because outsiders have got, again, typical middle class. They impose their interpretations, which are misguided and ignorant, on our words.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't use it to somebody from who didn't know what the term meant. And I called this old lady wench, and I got pulled in by the manager. "We don't like you using that word." I said, "Well, why not?" "It's a slur." He said, "No," I said, "it's not." The next Sunday, first call I got was from an old lady. And says, "Carl, I love it when you call us old uns wenches." And I thought, put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Yeah.
I had another occasion they did that. I was on holiday and the manager rang me up. He said, "We've had some focus groups. And they all agree that you're intelligent and you ask the right questions. You let people talk and they like the way that you bring in people of all backgrounds. But they don't like you, this one group doesn't." I said, "So they like everything that I do, but they don't like me." And Bill Bush comes, he says, "Yeah, it's your accent." I said, "So where was the group from?"
"Wiltshire."
"Sutton Coldfoot."
"Oh, Sutton Coldfoot."
Now, not knocking all Sutton Coldfoot people.
Yeah.
Because most are Brummies. But there is an element of people in our region who are ashamed of the way we speak. Well, I'm not.
That is astonishing. You can't imagine any other community or you would speak your native tongue and be called for it.
Yeah. And so it's something that I've focused on fighting is classism, accentism. People might say, "Well, you're making these terms up." No, you don't. No, you don't make these terms up. I've taught students I've taught at the university. She said, "Carl, I was sitting in the class, a small room like this, a seminar, and the lecturer went round and said, 'Oh, well, you won't know the answer to this because you went to a comprehensive.'" I said, "You've got to complain," but she was intimidated.
Yeah. You see these polls, don't you, going around Birmingham is the accent of Birmingham and this, that and the other. And
well, I won't answer. Very often people ring me up for the news and say, "What do you think of this latest poll?" I said, I don't react to them anymore because they're self-serving polls. They're not done on random sampling or with social scientific techniques. It's a group of perhaps 15 or 20 people. But it keeps on bringing it round and round. It's a self-defeating project, so I won't even respond to them anymore.
Yeah, because it's just going in you, sir.
And I'm not being a digger.
I suppose getting a quote from you is kind of, get a quote from
someone. So I'm feeling it anymore. Well, I'm feeling it anymore, I haven't done for years. And I'm not being a digger. If that could happen to me with a high profile that I've got, how hard is it for a working class kid who's trying to break through? 100%. So I'll keep on fighting and try and push that door of prejudice a little bit further open. Mm-hmm. And with God's grace, one day we'll knock it down.
Yeah. How do you find the Peaky Blinders stuff that you're doing at the moment? You're still doing all the Peaky Blinders?
No, I had to cut back quite a lot. Obviously, we had lockdown, so we stopped the...
What did you do during lockdown?
I was writing.
Was it?
Yeah, I was writing. And my wife, Kay, had breast cancer soon after. So thank God she's doing well.
Yeah.
But and the NHS I can't praise them enough.
Yeah.
I really can't. So I've had to cut back. I still go about doing a bit of teaching in schools, various projects. Do a lot of work with Archbishop Billsley and Acox Green.
Yeah.
A lot of work with them. A really interesting school with lots of the demographics have changed a lot. Whereas once it was mainly Irish, Brummie descent, now it's much more wide. But I go in and there's a wonderful group of teachers there that are so connected to the youngsters and want them to do well. Excuse me. I do a few talks a year for the Old Crown at the Old Library in Heathmill Lane, which is a stunning building to give a talkie.
Kieran's still got the Old Crown.
And so
that's all right, first part, wasn't it?
That's what we said. They asked me if I'd do a few tours this year. So I did one in December, and then I'm doing a few this year through the Old Crown.
Yeah.
But not as many as I used to do.
You used to be flat out, didn't you?
I used to love it, and I was teaching as well, because once you're freelance, you've got to take work when you can get it, you know that.
Yeah.
I'm still writing. I've just written another major book on the real Peaky Blinders.
Because that's what's the count, right? 30?
I've written 37 books
37?
Now. Yeah, 37 books now.
How long typically does one of them take?
It just depends. It all depends on the type of book it is and the amount of research. So, for example, the one, Peaky Blinders, The Aftermath and The Legacy, which were really looking at what happened to the gangs after. So let me just take you back a stage. The real Peaky Blinders, a small group of them, were the catalyst for organised crime in England. That's where there is a connection with the series. So you obviously you've seen the series. So series one, Billy Kimber, the guy who's running the racecourse rackets.
Yep.
How was he portrayed? Was he a small Londoner or a big Brummie?
Small Londoner, wasn't he?
He was a big Brummie, in reality.
Right.
I know his family, his descendants.
Yeah.
Billy Kimber was not a small Londoner. He was a big burly Brummie who'd been a Peaky Blinder. And a lot of the most vicious, violent criminals of the Peaky Blinders went racing. Why did they go racing? They went to small gangs of pickpockets. What are people carrying? Cash. Mm. And they didn't only pickpocket, they then started to blackmail the bookmakers for protection money. And by about 1910, 11, Billy Kimber had risen to control a loose collection of racecourse road from Birmingham, these little groups of six, seven, and he was the top boy of all of them. And he moved down south and he allied, he was very clever. He not only we've got a fearsome reputation as a fighter, but he got a brain. And he allied with the Garnhams from Chapel Market in Islington, who had a little mob, with George Sage from Camden Town and his mob, and the Elephant Boys, the McDonalds and the Elephant Boys from South London. And they took over the racecourse rackets down south. After the First World War, race of the tendencies boomed. A lot of men coming out with their gratuities. Most went home, but a lot wanted to booze and bet and enjoy themselves. And the Birmingham gang, a rough collection run by Billy Kimber, also known as the Brummagem Boys, dominated the racecourse rackets in the Midlands and the North, up to the top of Yorkshire, where the Newcastle gang took over. But basically, the Midlands and most of the North, Lancashire, most of Yorkshire, Cheshire, was run by the Birmingham gang. There, after the war, they moved down south, allied with their London pals, and took over down south, but they were racist. And they extorted extra money from the Jewish bookmakers. One of those Jewish bookmakers was a man called Alfie Solomon. Does the name ring a bell?
Tom Hardy again.
Yeah. So the series is called Solomon's. His real name was Solomon. How do I know that? I interviewed his younger brother in 1987 in a very rough pub in North London.
Really?
Yeah. Wouldn't let me interview. We called him. I had to write down my notes. I interviewed lots of other people in the mid-1980s. I was writing a book about illegal bookmaking because the family had been illegal bookies. And I went all over the country, up to Aberdeen, over to Norwich, down to Exeter, all over. But I wanted to learn more about racecourse bookmaking because we were off-course bookies. We never went racing because we were taking bets when the race was on. And the old man was president, our dad was president of the Birmingham Bookmakers Association, Protection Association, which I later found out was started by a criminal to go semi-legitimate. And Dad put me in touch with a load of old bookmakers, and it was they who told me about the racecourse war of 1921. Now, I wrote about that racecourse war in a book in 1991. I wrote about the real Peaky Blinders in my doctoral thesis in 1986. So I'm not trying to come lately.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been researching and writing about the real Peaky Blinders, the real Billy Kimber, the real Alfie Solomon for 40 years.
Have you spoken to Stephen about it? Is he?
I've not spoken to him.
No. I imagine he's called upon your work to research it.
Don't know. No. Met him fleetingly once, very fleetingly. And I shook his hand and said, thanks for what you've done for Birmingham. And that was it.
Seems like a partnership made in heaven, that does. You and Stephen, like, for Birmingham.
Mm-hmm. The thing is, obviously, for dramatic purposes, it's not like a slight on Stephen or what he does.
No.
You take something, you dramatise it. It's like based on true events, yeah, isn't it? Yeah. Pretty much 99% of all horrible films are.
Very successful in using real names like Billy Kimber, Darby Sabini. You know, so what happens is they call in Darby Sabini to protect the Jewish bookmakers. I interviewed the son of his main enforcer, Darby Sabini's main enforcer in 1987. So what I'm telling you about is based on 40 years of research into the Peaky Blinders, into the real gangs, and knowledge of them based on talking to people that were actually the gangsters or associated.
Shrek and Horses, mate.
Yeah.
legitimate sources.
And rare memoirs and masses of research into newspapers, into court records, National Archives, lots of records such as those. And so there were real people whose names are used, but the real people were very different to the fictionalised characters. So Tom Hardy, for example, how's he portrayed? Is he seen as an Orthodox Jewish guy with his long frock coat and his height? Of course he is. No. But he wasn't like that. Yeah. He was secular Jewish.
Yeah.
If it had been Orthodox, he'd have been in the synagogue, studying the Torah. Billy Kidman wasn't a small Londoner, he was a big burly probby from Summer Lane. So again, this is where the idea of football is silly, because these men in these gangs were from all the bad gangs of Birmingham.
Yeah.
They weren't football fans.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch upon some of the teaching that you do in school.
Yeah.
So I wasn't sure whether it was a Mandela effect thing in my head, but I'm sure when I was in primary school, we learned about Bjorn Ingerham.
Yes, yeah.
And I asked my daughter, I've asked my youngest kids now, whether any of them have heard of this story. And no, it doesn't get taught anymore.
I'm
not sure whether I imagined it or not, but I remember Bjorn Ingerham, was it? He came and said...
You may have heard, he's not the radio, could they?
Yeah. We went down and we done an assembly, we actually done a class.
Yeah, Dad, where was the school?
I went to the Rosary.
Yeah, the Rosary in Sutley.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, Sutley. It wasn't Bjorn, it was Bayorama Ingerham. So the ham is home. How do Scottish people say home?
Oh.
Hame.
Yeah.
So the A becomes an O in much of England, but we continue that A to an O in words like mom. Not ma'am, mom. Mm-hmm. Again, that was something I was pulled up for on the radio, saying mom. I was also pulled up for saying Alcester. For the Alcester Road.
What?
He said it should say Ulster. I said, no, it's Alcester Road.
Right, what's the source? What's the source? Yeah.
So Bayorama his ham was his home, homestead. Ingas were people, and Bayorama was a man's name. Might have been a shortened of Bayormund. And he was an immigrant. He was an Angle, a German. His people were Germanic, who come over from the borders of what is now Denmark and North Germany, the Jutland Peninsula. And on the Jutland Peninsula, just below the Danish border, is another small peninsula called the Angulen Peninsula. Well, who did the Angles give their name to?
England.
Angleland. England. Where did they first settle? Well, you look from Denmark, across the sea, east, Anglia, the land of the East Angles. And then they started to move west. And Bayorama would have been probably a small chieftain. Or an extended family, probably a warrior. And he would have arrived here probably in the mid-600s, about the time of the Staffordshire Hood, which is transforming our understanding of the so-called Dark Ages. And at the time when Penda, who was recording Penderford, the last pagan king of Mercia, and he's was bringing together all these little groups, tribal groups, into the Kingdom of Mercia. And we're not taught these things at school.
No. You'd think the origins of Birmingham would still be in some curriculum, wouldn't you? Especially at primary school level.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm really chuffed that when you were at school, it was taught. Because the most we was ever taught at school was that Bolton Motor Murdoch.
Right.
And we were taught that Birmingham was named after the De Birmingham family. No, it wasn't. The De Birminghams took their name from Birmingham. They were the Lords of Birmingham.
Yeah, see, this is the thing. It's nice to be verified and actually have that confirmed as well.
You're going to get Carl Jean's gold star, you ever?
Can you give me your name?
Yeah, I've got one in my pocket.
I've mentioned this to people before. People look at me like I've got it wrong. I'm lying or I've misunderstood. No, that is genuinely... Yeah, we had like an assembly for it and we all went back to class, but...
Really...
Shout out the Rosary Promise.
Well done.
Yeah. Mr. Catherine.
So your family, this Irish descent?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Where from?
Cavan.
Cavan.
Cavan, oh, mm. I'm not going to say nothing.
More pubs than people. We went over there once in the 90s and we were a couple of single lads no chance of pulling, because every time you went and spoke to like some women that were related to you,
yeah.
We're super be careful.
They call the hills around there drumlins, don't they?
That's it, yeah.
Drumlins, the land of drumlins. Mm. Yeah.
So we grew up Fifth Avenue, then Borsley Green.
Did you?
Right, stones away from there.
Yeah, so we used to walk to and from. Yeah.
Well, you would. And what's interesting there, all the roads are joined, apart from Sherrywood Road, which is a much older road,
yeah,
and Blake Street, which are much older. All the other ones are early 20th century. So look at the other roads that are down by you. Pretoria Road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Church
Road.
Buffer.
So what does that tell us?
Go on.
Second South African War.
Right.
Leader of the South African forces was General Bosman.
Churchill
was involved.
Right.
Pretoria is a major settlement, major town city in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So all those roads, apart from Fifth Avenue, Fordruff Lane is different. That's an old word. And I'm going to really upset you two now. It was originally owned by the Holts of Aston.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's where we moved.
And that way, again, it's silly, all these arguments between us.
Because we're all into...
We're all belong to each other.
Yeah.
You know, we all belong to each other.
Mm. I want to go to your MBA. How did all that happen? What's your...
I didn't know. It was a result of John Major bringing in people's MBEs, whereas instead of being recommended by these worthies, that people could raise petitions or whatever to get somebody, but I didn't know several people had raised petitions. And I've got the positions, it was very moving. And when I got it, I mean, my family were royalists, my mum and dad, Backstreet kids, all my family was so ecstatic. And my wife says, Kay said, Carl, you always felt, I felt that it wasn't just for me. I felt it was for us, belonged to us. So I said to him, why don't you mention on the radio that you're going to have a drink up the town and people can meet you? So I said, we're going to have a drink in the old crowd. But when I got there, it was rammed. And the Irish Pipe band piped me in. Oh, well, that was so moving. And the mail then was selling lots of copies, and they did a big front page with Carl Chin MBE. And they took it round the pub and people signed it. I've got it in the office. One of my most prized possession. So it was for contribution to charity and to local history. Because what I did with charity, I didn't do big events. What I like to do, and I've had to cut back, but what I like to do is go to small local places that got very little attention in working class districts. I give a talk for nothing, bring a few books, raise some money from sales of the books of the charity, and I
get some money behind the bar.
Yeah. You know, it helped. And I'm not saying I was better or worse than anybody else, but that was my approach. I think some people do the big events, like at the Symphony Hall and places like that. But for me, I preferred to go into the community.
That's brilliant.
Much preferred that.
Mm.
I've done a lot with the Irish, obviously, as you know, over the years. Although I'm married to an Irish woman, I don't know if you know that, my wife Kay's from Dublin. Right. Yeah, love of my life. We met 47 years ago in the most exotic holiday location, the Pig and Whistle in Benidorm. Yeah, true. Walked in with my mate, with our kid and my mates, with Paul with some Chelsea fans, and we were stopping at what? Do you know Benidorm?
Yes.
You know, the English Quarter, so the square, the English square. So we were stopping by there. I think we were in the Hotel Creplum, and decided one the Saturday night we were going to go into the old town, and walked in this, we must have had a good drink, and we walked in this little pub, still there, and this beautiful looking Irish girl turned around with milky white skin, beautiful green eyes, long dark hair, and I fell in love with her. And then we'd be chatted up by Dutch guys. I just walked over, and I was never confident with girls, but that day at night I must have had a couple of three.
Yeah.
And I just went up to her and said, just fall in love with you, will you marry me? And they looked at me, he says, you're a drunken Englishman. And I don't know where I got that idea from. And we met again by accident the next day in a pub called Champions, which was a gathering point back then. And we wrote to each other for 4 months. And she flew over to Birmingham in the January, which was the third time we met, and I proposed. And she said yes. And the next day, before we went to get the engagement ring, I had to ring up her dad, Mr. Doyle. in Finglas West, a very tough estate in North Dublin, to ask permission to marry his beloved Irish Catholic daughter. And Mr. Doyle thought it was bad enough his beloved Irish Catholic daughter was married an English Protestant, whom she'd met in a pub called the Pig and Whistle. But with my name of Chin, they thought I was Chinese English Protestants. And the mob used to go, when you've got the love letters, go, what's this Warro about me? What does Warro about me? Are you sure these fellas? Is he English, Chinese? What nationality is he?
That's brilliant.
We got married in the September.
Where's you married?
In Dublin.
Did you?
Yeah, in the Church of the Annunciation. I think I was the only left footer ever to get married in there. Wouldn't give me communion.
Left footer.
Wouldn't give me communion.
No.
I think I was the first member of my family to get confirmed since the Reformation. Because Anglicans, Church of England, it's actually matching, dispatching, births, deaths, and marriages.
Yeah.
But I wanted to have the, because I am religious, I don't push it on anybody, it's my faith. Don't go to church, but I have a faith. And I wanted to have, because it was the sacrament of marriage, I wanted the sacrament of the communion. So I got confirmed at St. Christopher's Church, Springfield. And I got a letter off the vicar saying I was a confirmed member of the Church of England. The creed is the same, I believe in one holy Catholic apostolic church, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the night before the wedding, the priest, I don't forget, I'm going back 46 years now, 47 this year. And the night before the wedding, the priest said, now Kay's family come up in the rehearsal. He said, Kay's family come up for the communion. And Kay went, well, what about Carl? He said, I can't give Carl the communion. Everybody knows Kay Doyle is married an English Protestant. He said, but if you come in on Sunday, nobody will know who you are. I'll give you communion then. I was really disappointed, to be honest with you. Really disappointed. Kay had to get a letter from the Bishop of Dublin to allow her to marry across the impediments of religion. So that's been my problem for the rest of my life. I've been called an impediment, but I'm just...
I've been called similar.
These worse words.
So just concluding then, I mean, what's the future? What's 2025 and beyond? When's the book out?
The book will probably be out next this year. Thanks to publishers now. I'm doing a few research projects now for good causes and charities and businesses that want, you know, perhaps they've got a building, they want to know the history of the building. And I'm enjoying that because I love my research. I'm enjoying
it. Quite easy researching. Do you find it easy?
Oh, yeah, I love it. Yeah. And I'm lucky in that I've got a huge archive. I've got a big library for books. I've got rid of a lot. I've got a lot of books out. But I've got all the letters of people, thousands of letters people have written me over the years. And most of them now are on my computer, or many of them are. Thousands of photos, lots of old rare books that I found and I've been able to download. So I've got a lot of stuff that I can work from home with. Sometimes I have to go down to Kew, to the National Archives, or I haven't been to the Library of Birmingham for a long time because I've got all the stuff that I need really at hand, which is important because I haven't got the time anymore.
You know, the importance of physical media as well.
Yes.
It's come round full circle, hasn't it? Yeah. That everything was online and don't worry, you can get it digitally, and all of a sudden the importance of books. Vinyl records, CDs, DVDs.
And I've got so many of the old books, very rare books that I've been
accumulating. The library will be coming to you and they
Well, I've left them in my will to the library. Because I've got memoirs from Brummies that the library hasn't got. People send me private copies. You know, there's only for the family, Carl, five or six copies, but we want you to have one. So I do a lot of work from home. We've got a lot of family responsibilities. So I've got to, now I'm 68, I've got to fit the work in now to the family responsibilities. I've got to get that balance right. I love the research and I'm enjoying the fact that, you know, like I did that tour in December, I've got one coming up in a couple of 3 weeks. The fact there's just perhaps one every month or every couple of months, I'm enjoying that.
Kids fingering.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm also, I've got to keep working. You know, when I lost my job at the university and then very quickly afterwards, I was dropped from the radio. So that I lost my two main forms of income.
Yeah.
I'm fortunate in that we were able to sell the house. Obviously, it was too expensive. The mortgage was too high. We're mortgage free. Very happy where we're living. We've got great neighbours. So.
And I bet you turn more work down than you do you or not?
I think.
I imagine there's a lot of people trying to get your attention.
Yeah, a lot because, and I think because I'm radical and outspoken, and shab for the working class, I don't get the kind of work from.
Yeah, you don't toe the line, do you?
Yeah, that's right. The PC work.
Yeah,
you don't toe the line.
You know,
you are literally blowing smoke into your rear end. You're a treasure of Birmingham, aren't you?
What you
do for Birmingham, the Midlands. Even in my lifetime, I've been listening to you on the radio since I was an apprentice electrician 25 years ago, and through the TV, radio, and then most recently LinkedIn, you're a proud advocate of sticking up for buildings and businesses under threat in Birmingham, aren't you? How do you find, talking of kind of linking in with what we were talking about there, do you find even with the council and people with a vested interest in just building and building and building, are you something of like a kind of, what's the word?
Thorn in the side.
Thorn in the side.
Yeah, yeah.
And you, is that the impression that you get?
Oh, very strongly. The people I belong to are you lot. And what I want on my gravestone is our car. Because as long as I've got your respect and your friendship, that means everything to me. But yes, I've been pushed out. I'm held more than arm's length because you shout out, because I march for jobs, because I attend protest meetings, because I do such a lot on LinkedIn now. I never knew about LinkedIn until about 4 years ago, but it's a great way for being able to publicise the closure of our youth facilities, the closure of our libraries, and say this is not right.
Yeah.
You know, what? Our most vulnerable communities are struggling. We've got half of the babies in our city living in poverty. I'm ashamed of that. Where I live, close to the Ardenwood Road, we had a load of rubbish dumped on the slip road. 6 weeks ago, hasn't been moved. Despite people contacting the council, I'm not knocking the workers because they're under pressure. Now, there's seven or eight dumps now, because once one dump's left, it attracts. That's the Birmingham that we're living in now. How much do the Commonwealth Games benefit poorer Brummies?
Yeah,
no. Not at all. It's all very well going for these fancy projects, but your first priority should be the people, the working class people. 2/3 of Birmingham Council's homes are in a bad condition. Damp, black mould, horrible conditions for kids and families to live in. Our council's got to get a grip and start to think, we've got to look after our own before we start thinking of big projects like the Commonwealth Games. They're ego trips. So yeah, I am held, and I've been told on numerous occasions that senior figures have said, don't touch Carl T, don't go near him, don't help him.
Mm. You think it would make sense that does. For the reverse, wouldn't it? Embrace you and what you stand for. Blues at the moment, the work they're doing, the Canadian Players tonight have come in, has been impactful, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So it's nice that they've leaned that way into the community and they're doing what
I think it's really important. To be fair to the Villa, the foundation, the Aston Villa Foundation, is doing really good work as well. So I think both clubs recognise there is a need to link into the community. But I think there's still a lot more that needs to be done with working class neighbourhoods. You know, Small Heath today has got a very large Somali community and Kashmiri descent, Brummies. So there's a need there. Aston and Lozell's a mixture of Bangladeshi Brummies and Kashmiri Brummies. We need to do a lot more, but equally, we need to reach out to white working class areas. Chelmsford Wood for the Blues, particularly, King Standing for the Villa and other areas.
Yeah.
You know, Falkland Lodge in Sutton Coldfield for the Villa, Kingshurst for the Blues. We need to do, so I think there's a big start being made by both clubs, but I believe there's a lot more should be done.
Yeah.
Because we need to get into Hockley and Newtown. You know, how many great young black players have we all had? And yet how many black supporters do we see? It's increased, it's got better, but there's a long way to go. There's a long way to go. We need a South Asian kid to break through. into football. Yeah. You know, that's what will break racism down best, is when you see youngsters who are born and bred here or come here, doesn't matter, wearing our shirts.
Yeah.
Or going on to wear an England or an Ireland shirt. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But no, it's I think there is that glass ceiling. I've done well in my life and I've achieved things, but I know I've hit that ceiling. And again, that's why I keep fighting, because if that happens to me with my profile, how hard is it for a young working class kid with no profile to break through?
Yeah.
And that angers me. The class discrimination in this country, the accent discrimination in this country anger me.
You see now, don't you, with the Tory government going out, Labour coming in, it's not Labour, is it? It's not a traditional Labour government. It's not a working people's Labour government.
There's a massive problem in politics in that we have very few MPs who are not only just from, not from working class, but from the business middle class. How many small businessmen and women could get into Parliament? Because if you do, you have to give up your job. Or you have to take your eye off the ball and your business goes under. You can't get... That's why, I know it's controversial, but when the Chartists started, the world's first great working class movement, one of the first things they fought for was payment of MPs. Because unless you're paid, how can a working class person or a small businessman go into Parliament? So I would actually increase MPs' wages to try and open it up. So it's not just the lawyers and solicitors and professionals going into Parliament. We need in all political parties a much wider and diverse base.
Demographic.
Much better. It needs to change, because what we're being ruled by a small group of people, of professional middle class people, of difference, whether it's Labour, Tory, Lib Dem. You can look at the profiles and how many of... There's so few now from working class backgrounds. When I was growing up, I remember there was a Liverpudlian MP called Battling Bessie Braddock. She was a working class woman. One of the great heroes of Birmingham was Percy Shermer. Vote for Percy Shermer. You know, working class people who came through. But now politics seems to become a profession in itself.
Yeah.
And that's a worry. You couldn't give up your business to become a politician. You couldn't give up yours.
We have these conversations at work and things like the national insurance hike and various changes have been made since the government took power, Labour took power of the government. You say, where's the feedback? Where does the feedback get back to government? Where's the advisory board?
Yeah.
Who is guiding them from businesses on the impact?
Yeah.
And then you hear interviews. I'm not sure if it was Jess Phillips or Crosby on that, but there was an interview, I think, on one of the news shows. And they were saying, yeah, we've spoke to 50 businesses and generally they're really happy with what we're doing. And the presenter said, can you name one of those businesses? And you couldn't name one.
No.
And it's the spin, then the political turn right of, oh no, these businesses, and there's not a direct answer to the question. No. You come away going, who did they speak to then? And it's not even try and catch a mate. No. Genuinely, I'm curious, which businesses, you know, have advised that was a good move?
And to stand as an independent is almost impossible. So a few years ago when we had the first elected West Midlands mayor, a lot of people say, Carl, are you going to stand? Now, I was never going to stand. I'm not a politician. I'm a social historian. I am a campaigner. But if I was in a position where I could have made workers redundant after fighting for jobs, I couldn't do that. So I'm not interested. I don't want to be hated.
Mm.
If I understood, right, I need money as an independent, right? It's massive. 3.5 million people from Wolverhampton, in the West, country in the East, with Birmingham, the Black Country, Solihull. So you need money. So as an independent, how are you going to get money? Well, I had a very wealthy businessman come to me. If you do stand, Carl, I'll back you. What would he want from me?
And therein lies a like politics, isn't it?
Correct. So he wants something from me. So I said, no. Now, who are the only other people that would have supported me, lads? Working class people. Am I going to take money from people who are struggling?
The great good, though.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I know what you're saying.
But, you know, 3.5 million to reach, you need hundreds of volunteers. Mm. You need so much money, okay, so much.
Well, you look at then, don't you, the donors for various Labour MPs that have put them up in flats in London, free of charge, and it's a very murky world, isn't it, once you get into donors and lobbying. And
I think this is the problem, is that the money, the financial, the cash nexus just takes over everything. And I do hope that, that the government can keep to some of its promises. Like, I was listening to the Prime Minister this morning, he spoke very well about the NHS and codgy back way down, but the proof will be in the pudding. And let's hope something is done. I found that the other side, you're knocking the government now, but you're in for 14 years. Surely you had time to look at the NHS, to look at the prison reform, to look at our defence in a dangerously changing world.
See, that's the hot potato is immigration, isn't it? And the Tories are coming out saying we're going to do this, that and the other. And Labour is saying it was a deliberate act that, you know, the borders were opened. Like I said, these are 14 years in power. It was a deliberate act. Hang on, you go further back, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, you started it, and it's just...
Yeah.
That's where you can't call it off. Nigel Farage and reform. Is that really the only alternative?
And what we need to look at is from a human perspective. Instead of seeing immigrants, this dangerous group, when you go to hospital, how many white faces are they treated now?
That's true, yeah.
There's a lot. My mum was seriously ill and she fell and she cut her ear and it just wouldn't stop bleeding. It was a tiny, but it was pouring the blood. We managed to get her to hospital. The only one that could get a stitch in was a refugee from Syria. So we've got to stop blaming and demonising people. And what we should be doing is having a proper legal way for people to be assessed to come in. We know we're a small island, we can't take everybody, that's obvious. But we also need to recognise that people do want to come here, and if they do, your Irish mom, dad, grandparents.
Grandparents,
you know, my wife, you know, people come here for work. My family moved from the villages of North Warwickshire into Birmingham for work. Might have been a way back, but we're still the same parents. So let's do it in a humane way. Let's do it properly, and let's not neglect poor communities that are already under stress. That's the problem. We look where the riots happened, and I'm condemning the riots. Let's look where they happened. White working class areas that have had no investment. Where do the governments put refugees in their large numbers? In poor neighbourhoods that are already under stress. Well, why not let's have some refugee centres in middle class areas? Let's start spreading things around. Why should it be places where there's high levels of deprivation? Not enough schools, not enough doctors, not enough work, where there's dire poverty. Why should poorer communities, whether it's white, black, South Asian, bear the burden? Let's look at this in a much more humane and holistic manner. I'm a very proud Englishman, and I'm proud to be married to an Irish woman. I've got mixed race cousins. I'm proud of England, but my England is a good England. It's an inclusive England. And my patriotism, my love for my country, is include all.
Love it. On that note,
I definitely think politics is it's a shame there isn't a headway into politics that is acceptable to you, because it's stirring. And that's a beautiful way to end the interview, yeah. Thing.
Express.
Perfect.
Thank you very much.
Thank you ever so much for your time, today, Paul.
You tell my wife missus that I'm a legend. I don't believe it.
Can we get a key prot on, will you? No? Okay.
Oh, he's good. Do you like me?